For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, DUI attorneys are filing a constitutional challenge against a bill to crack down on drunk drivers. The measure removes the administrative process to reinstate a driver's license and makes it illegal to refuse a breathalyzer test. Ryan, what do you think about this lawsuit?
Well, they're bringing this lawsuit under the Oklahoma Constitution's prohibition to violation of the single subject rule. And so they're saying that there are multiple subjects in this bill. And so I think that a lot of folks and the opponents of this litigation will say, well, you're really just trying to take it easy on DUIs and, you know, drunk drivers. And, you know, you can make that argument, but at the end of the day, that's really not what this is about. This is a big jumbled piece of mess of legislation. And the governor's executive order in the wake of it, I think, demonstrates even the executive's look at this as something that they've got to, you know, come up with some new administrative way to look at this, because the bill itself just really isn't workable. And so you've got the executive, the governor weighing in with this order, and then multiple subjects here. The single subject rule in the Oklahoma Constitution is really there so that legislators are able to vote on one piece of legislation, and they don't have to choose between something that they may not like to pass something that they do. So that's the point here, is that, you know, they may not like the other portion of this bill that says, you know, we're going to make it a crime now to refuse the breathalyzer, but they may like the other parts. So there may be good things in this bill, but they should come back and do it again. That's probably what the court's going to make them do.
Neva.
I think that's right. I think even the attorneys conceded that the bill probably had a noble purpose, but that what needed to happen now was to right the wrongs that were created in this legislation. And this legislation really, Senator David and Representative Biggs, was really the result of the governor's DUI task force, and they really kind of came forward with this, even though there were identified issues. No one seemed to want to put alternative measures on the table, so they went with this. They were able to get the votes, and now they've got to go to court, unfortunately, and clean up what clearly much of this probably could have been alleviated on the front end, but was not.
Neva, Ryan, I got to ask you about the due process. The attorneys are also, they're not claiming that on the Constitution, but is there concern about basically saying you have to take a breathalyzer test, you can't go through the administrative process to get your driver's license back, that these things stop the due process rights of a citizen?
Well, and the Supreme Court has held that a driver's license is a property right, mm-hmm. and if you're going to take that property right away from somebody, it's got to be more than just the government's word against yours. And, you know, we can say, listen, you know, a highway patrol officer, a police officer, you know, they see somebody that's intoxicated, they should be able to take that license away. Well, they're going to take that driver off the road immediately. That's going to happen. It's really what happens after that. And your rights as a citizen to be able to say, you know, I want to challenge the word of this officer. I want to be able to challenge the government's insistence that I take a breathalyzer test or give a blood sample. You know, these are things that, you know, we have a right to be able to challenge and to contest. And if you take away that ability and it really becomes a question of an officer saying this person was drunk, and then the government and the court system saying, okay, well, we have to go by that and take this person's license away for 12 months, 24 months, or even longer, and impose huge fees on this individual, you know, $25 a month in some instances to be able to, you know, drive a car. I mean, these are big penalties that we're talking about here. Sometimes they're very worthwhile. You know, sometimes we need to make sure that these folks are never on the road again. But if you're going to put those penalties out there, you know, as severe as they are, you got to have some sort of process that goes along with that.
Oral arguments begin August 8th on Oklahoma's new law putting a $1.50 fee per pack of cigarettes to reduce the amount of smokers in the state. Two major national tobacco companies are challenging the measure in the state Supreme Court. Neva, how concerned should the governor and lawmakers be over this lawsuit?
Well, I think anytime you have something like this come about, I mean, you have to be concerned. And I think with respect to the court hearing this case on the 8th, the law is supposed to go into effect on August 25th. So, I mean, I think we will see a very expedited review and discussion of this. And clearly, there are a lot of issues. I mean, there are a lot of significant issues on the constitutionality of the way this came about. And, you know, whichever one you want to hang your hat on, I think all of them have, at least at this point, are considered to have merit. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens and whether this has some ramifications, not only on the budget, but whether the governor is put in a place where a special session needs to be considered or some other outlet.
Ryan.
You know, this is like, you know, whenever Orange is the New Black, it was released early because of hackers, and everybody kind of, if you wanted to, you knew how the story was going to end, how the season was going to end. Well, here we kind of knew how this was going to end. I mean, you know, the predictions were out there. You had legislators, Republicans and Democrats, during the debate on this measure saying, this is unconstitutional. We're not doing this the right way. This is a revenue-raising measure. It needs to start in the House. You have to get the supermajority in the legislature to pass it. And everybody was calling it a tax all session long until the political negotiations broke down and the Republican leadership said, well, we're not going to call it a tax anymore. We're going to call it a fee increase. That's not how this works. And the case law on this is very clear. The court will give a lot of deference to the legislature when it comes to, you know, what is and isn't a revenue raising measure, but that deference only goes so far. I mean, this is just common sense. We know what this is. We know it's a tax increase. I'm surprised auto dealers and other folks that have been subject to other very obvious tax increases that came out of the legislature that they've, you know, tried to somehow call fee increases. I'm surprised they haven't filed cases as well. This is going to be struck down. I mean, I think that it's the odds are, you know, overwhelming in favor of that outcome. And we're more than likely going to see the governor have to call the legislature back into special session. Now, whether Speaker McCall and other legislative leaders come back and answer that call or we get across the board cuts, I mean, that's the real question here. That to me is the uncertain outcome.
This isn't Jerry Fent coming up against this lawsuit, which I kind of expected. These are the major tobacco companies. This is Marlboro and Camel and all them coming up and saying, you can't do it. They've got plenty of money to spread around if they were to decide to keep this lawsuit.
Absolutely. And not only from the legal side of it, but for the future, does this bring into consideration some of these groups looking at future state questions or other things to address a lot of these matters? So it's a wide open ball game, and I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens when it gets before the Supreme Court.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you know, the Tobacco Settlement Endowment Trust, their executive director, John Woods, he's come out and he's demonized the tobacco industry. Man, and demonized those guys all day long. You know, they killed my grandfather, and, you know, both of my parents, you know, smoke, and it worries me. And, you know, these folks aren't the kind of people that we want to protect. But the fact of the matter is that's not where the blame goes here. The blame goes to the legislature. They couldn't get their act together, and they put this budget together with bailing wire, and now it's all coming undone. And we knew it was going to. And so, you know, this really goes back to legislative leadership, their inability to get a budget put together and passed in a way that would pass constitutional scrutiny. And that's what we're left with right now.
Oklahoma's two biggest universities are calling on the state's regents to approve tuition increases after state lawmakers cut higher education by nearly 4.5%. Other colleges are considering increases in tuition as well as a bump in things like room and board. Ryan, your thoughts on these requests first off?
Well, Keith Gaddy, a professor at the University of Oklahoma, chair of the political science department on Facebook, and he said this before, but he said that the University of Oklahoma has gone from a state-funded institution to a state-supported institution to what is now a state-located institution. And I think that we're beginning to see that. You know, the way that we're funding higher education in the state of Oklahoma has gone more and more on the backs of the students that are going there and their parents and the folks that are in private institutions and private donors. We've gone to last in the nation in support for higher education in terms of, you know, what we're spending from the state side of things. You know, this is a real crisis. And, you know, there was a, you know, kind of buried in the headline, you know, the buried lead here is this funding issue and the increase in fees and tuition. But one of the things that got a big amount of attention was at the University of Oklahoma, Lloyd Noble, the parking lot there where everybody, students have parked for free for years and then bused to campus, they were going to start charging parking there. And that got this huge outcry. Everybody was really angry, as they should be. President Boren backtracked on that decision. I wish he wouldn't have, not because I want people to have to pay for parking there. I don't think that they should have to. But like I've been telling superintendents for years, if you want to get attention from the public on the education budget crisis, turn the lights off on Friday night. You know, do something where people realize the impact of these cuts. Don't just try to internalize them, raise fees, and do what you can to mitigate it so that people don't feel the pain. There's real pain out there. And even if it's these headlines like the parking lot closure that get the attention, get the attention.
Neva.
Well, but there's more to this story. And I think when you put it in a broader context, when you look at colleges and universities in Oklahoma, first of all, we have 42 four-year colleges and universities in the state. We have 148 total in the higher education system. That includes community colleges and trade schools as well as the four-year institutions. So when you look at all of that and you say we always have this focus on, in this instance, the 4.5% less money coming from the legislature, but in totality, you have to look at where's the supply and demand, and what is the real need in terms of higher education in the state. I mean, during the last decade, when there has been a continual kind of reduction in appropriations over and over, year in and year out to these colleges and universities, we've also seen the proliferation of more and more of these campuses and colleges being created around the state. And do we have too many? Is it time to look at, when we are looking at the dollars, is it time for all of these folks to come to the table and say there are better ways that we can do it to afford every student an opportunity to be able to get a college education if they choose, to make sure that they know where the appropriate scholarships and other avenues to get money? The student loans are not just the only place, but then take into consideration that it also is that public and private component that no one ever talks about when they talk about just tuition increases. And the other side of it is, when we look at higher ed, we never factor in the fact that in the cases of the, let's say, in the cases of the major universities in the state, there's a much higher tuition rate for those out-of-state students than there are in-state students. And those students bear a big percentage of the brunt of what is needed to fund these budgets.
And the Journal Record had a great story on Wednesday, and it was also looking at the fact that if college is unreachable, that reduces reduces wages, which reduces taxes. I mean, how this becomes a cyclical effect. If you can't get more of Oklahoma students, yeah, out of state's good, but if you can't get more Oklahoma kids in college, you're going to hurt Oklahoma's tax base in the future.
And that's where those two-year schools and those regional colleges and universities do a magnificent job. And, you know, so if we're putting those investments in communities and people have access to them. And we're not just talking about students that are graduating out of high school. We're talking about people that are trying to retrain, get new tools for a 21st century workforce. Whether that's Seminole State College or a regional university like Rogers State, or even some of our, one of our crown jewels, one of our liberal arts institutions, USAO and Chickasha. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got some amazing higher ed institutions in the state of Oklahoma, and the return on investment there is beyond what we're getting anywhere else in our investments in the state of Oklahoma. To cut that and to shrink those opportunities for Oklahoma students, whether they're non-traditional students or coming right out of high school, I think is a big mistake.
But again, the question is, if they're taking cuts in their budget, are they just passing through those cuts to the students, or are they making administrative cuts and other considerations within the framework of their overall budget to be able to accommodate some of that belt tightening?
Well, those cuts
are happening. But what I'm saying is, they're doing it on the backs of the students as opposed to doing it on the backs of reducing some of the overhead that clearly, over and over and over again, we talk about is one of the issues that I think creates this public sentiment sometimes of, we want to see some effort on your part to be able to show us that you really are efficiently using the tax dollar.
Well, and while 4.5% is pretty bad from this past year, what most people aren't mentioning is the fact that we've been seeing reductions over the past 10 years and a 16% cut last year that was never returned, even though it was all about state question 779.
So you had a 16% cut. We're at over 20% over the last 5 years for a lot of these institutions, and some institutions close to 30% loss in funding. And there have been cuts. I mean, you look at even just the University of Oklahoma, and they've had early retirement package offers for folks, and they're not replacing those. And so you're losing administrative staff, you're losing teaching staff, and when you're doing that and you're not replacing it, you're The yeah, of course. I mean, the the real pain here is felt by the students, both in their tuition increase, but also in the number of classes that are offered, and the size of the classes that are offered, and the types of curriculum that you're able to provide for your students there. They're the ones paying the price. But ultimately, as you mentioned, Michael, and in that Journal Record story talks about, the price is paid by Oklahomans because we're losing revenue as the number of graduates and the quality of graduates that we're able to put out decreases.
Well, I think that article also pointed out that in the case of, let's say, UCO, that 15 years ago, 60% of their budget was appropriated monies, and now it's 22%. So what we see is as they have seen the reductions in their appropriations, they've not been able to successfully mitigate against that and find ways internally within these respective institutions to be able to deal with it, other than do the typical Hail Mary of we're just going to pass it through to the students, and that's not a good way to do business.
While I was away on vacation, Governor Fallon set a special election date. Yes, I know. Of November 14th. This is to replace Tulsa Senator Dan Newberry, with primary set for September 12th. Newberry announced his resignation effective at the end of January next year. Do you think that now that we're going to have it in November, that this might change his effective resignation date?
As I understand it, it won't. And so I don't know all of the nuances, but apparently the filing period, the election as it's set, will take place, and his resignation. So the timing of that will hopefully make for more of a seamless transition. I think that may be part of what was looked at. But when you're looking at 7 special elections just back-to-back-to-back through this year for a variety of reasons, most resignations, one, a death of a lawmaker. Right. I mean, it is astounding, and there's a lot of speculation that we may see others before the end of the year that will step away for various reasons. So, again, it's become kind of a growth industry for folks in my business in terms of these constant special elections. But in terms of what it does for the voters in those respective districts, it's very disruptive. Special elections are very low turnout, so it's very difficult to make sure that the voters are aware and that they actually have an opportunity to make a decision on who's going back to represent them.
Ryan, should Newberry step down once there's another person elected into his office?
If he shouldn't step down immediately. I mean, I think that, you know, the idea that he has to be in that office for that office to continue to serve the constituents of Senate District 37 is just ridiculous. I mean, we're in an interim right now. There's somebody in that office that can field constituent calls, help do a lot of the coordination between constituents and state agencies and the services that are provided there. If Senator Newberry is sticking around for a special session, you know, he should say that. But this idea that he needs to be there till January 31st is just ridiculous. The only thing that's happening there is that he's collecting benefits. He's adding to the amount of retirement that he's paying in, and he's getting a salary. He doesn't need that. I mean, he's taking this high-profile, I'm presuming high-paying job with a credit union. I mean, he needs to step aside. We're looking at, if there's a primary, the general election would be November 14th. If there's not a primary, we're looking September 12th. He should say right now, Senator Newberry could say right now, I'm going to stick around until the general election, whenever that is, whether that's the September 12th or November 14th, and then shortly after that, step down. He doesn't need to be there till the 31st, and he should do that. And that way, you know, if there is a special session, it's hard to imagine that there would be one before then. But if there is, you know, he would be around and be able to represent the district. And if not, then he needs to, you know, go on his own.
Also, while I was away, Transportation Secretary Gary Ridley announces his retirement. Ridley has been active in Oklahoma transportation since 1965. I have lost count of the number of times I've interviewed the man. Ryan, your thoughts on this man who has given more than 50 years of service to the state's roads and bridges?
I mean, here's a real public servant and somebody who has been a diligent voice for transportation in the state of Oklahoma. We think about him with roads and bridges. I did a lot of work with him whenever I was a legislator, working to rehabilitate some of Oklahoma's short line railroads. Mm-hmm. And you know, so you know, he has a deep knowledge of every facet of transportation in the state of Oklahoma. You know, I think we're fortunate that he has, you know, brought that expertise to bear for Democratic governors, that he was appointed under Brad Henry. He's continued to serve under Mary Fallon. You know, he's somebody who I think that has an agenda, but his agenda is very well out in the open, you know, that he wants to invest in what he believes is the best plan for Oklahoma's transportation system. I wish him well in his retirement. I find it difficult to believe that he's going to be able to sit entirely on the sidelines here. But with Mike Patterson, you know, taking over, and here's somebody, you know, the new Secretary Patterson, who I can't recall a meeting with Gary Ridley where Secretary Patterson wasn't nearby.
I know. Yeah. Ever since like the 90s.
We talk about seamless transitions. This is the kind of continuity that, especially in a difficult budget time, I think is going to serve the transportation sector well.
Neva.
I would agree with you totally, Ryan, on that point. I mean, he made every effort to ensure not only the seamless transition when he left ODOT, but then in his transition now with the cabinet post. And I think Governor Fallon was right. His name is synonymous with roads and bridges, and he's one of those individuals in public service who literally started from the ground up. I mean, he was an equipment operator. He moved through every phase and every level of one of the largest agencies in the state government, and has someone that you never hear a bad word about. I mean, he is a man who gained the respect, as you say, on both sides of the aisle, was very even-handed and very deliberate in what he did, and had the respect not only here in Oklahoma, but even in the federal, at the federal level. Right. He testified many times before Congress, had the respect of many of his peers across state lines, and so he is someone who will be missed, but thankfully he has ensured, I think, in this transition, someone who is up to speed and knows the road and will continue to do what is a very important work in the state of Oklahoma.
And critically important work. There are people who are alive today who would not be alive had it not been for the leadership of Gary Ridley, because, you know, the things that he put in place through ODOT and as Secretary of Transportation, the cable barriers that we look that are ubiquitous on interstate highways today, and we think, well, of course those are there. Well, there was a time not that long ago where it was not,
just
of
walls.
Course, there was just walls, or it was just an open field. And, you know, so...
And I think part of that was the education process that he brought continually, not only to lawmakers, but to county government, to folks at every level, and even in the private sector, where people understood. So it wasn't a fight. When things needed to happen, there were coalitions that just naturally evolved that made those things less difficult than they would have been otherwise.
And although you, Ryan, you mentioned he had an agenda, he did work with both sides of the aisle so comfortably. Are there lessons that maybe we can learn on bipartisan from this man?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, his ability to, I think, walk into a room with the idea that he was going to let his expertise govern the decision-making process that he was ultimately going to engage in as both director of ODOT and then later on as Secretary of Transportation, and to not worry about, and, you know, here's somebody who, you know, very obviously never had any interest, or at least any expressed interest in elected office. And so he was there,
yet.
And this gubernatorial race isn't crowded enough. I think that, you know, when he walked into those rooms, the meetings that I always had with him, he brought in a lot of information, and he tried to let that information dictate the direction of his decision-making process.
Yeah, it was all more about the information than which party was going.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.